Good day. Today is Wednesday, 1st October 2025, and with apologies, I'm going to start this programme by discussing the political situation in Britain, where the governing Labour Party has had its conference, its annual conference, addressed by the British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer. And I was listening to the speech, and I was listening to the delegates, the other people who spoke at the conference, and I was watching the delegates cheer and applaud Keir Starmer as he gave his speech. And, well, straightforwardly, I have never known a time when a governing party seemed so completely detached from reality, so profoundly unconnected with the realities of life outside the conference centre as it was whilst I was watching it yesterday. It seems to me that there is a fundamental disjunction between the political class, the increasingly small political class, and the increasingly narrow demographic that continues to support them, and the realities of life outside that class and outside the government, the leadership of Britain. Now, just briefly, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, basically he had very little actually to say of any practical kind. I mean, he didn't really produce any new economic strategies or infrastructure programs or education programs or housing programs or any of those things. Basically, his speech seemed to revolve around two issues. Firstly, talking up the state of the British economy and of British society in general, which, against a backdrop of declining real wages and increasingly tough economic conditions for most people, I think will have struck a discordant note if they bothered to listen to what Keir Starmer had to say on these points, which, frankly, I doubt many people did. And the second, a splenetic attack on Nigel Farage and on reform, which the only thing it will have done, in my opinion, is to give even more time and attention and interest, stir even more interest in Nigel Farage and his Reform Party than might otherwise have been the case. Certainly, the Prime Minister's attempt to present himself as the true patriot, as against Nigel Farage, who supposedly is not, will, outside the conference centre, I think, strike an odd chord with most people. The other thing that happened at the Labour conference is that even as the Prime Minister himself had nothing interesting or useful or important to say about anything, the challenge to the Prime Minister from the Mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, seemed to sputter and go out. Burnham was indeed there. He met several people, but it was quite obvious that he had no real ideas, no real programme, no real policies to present either. So this is the reality in Britain. It is also the reality in France. It is the reality in Germany as well. It is, to some extent at least, the reality in Spain, though at least the Spanish Prime Minister, Mr. Sanchez, does have a plan of a kind, which is to open up Spain to immigration, mostly from Latin America, which is what currently is adding GDP growth numbers to the overall Spanish economy. So across Europe, there really isn't any kind of plan, any plan that remotely addresses the concerns and needs and worries and fears and aspirations of the general wider European population. Certainly that is not true in Britain. What we get instead is fear of Russia primarily, which is being talked up relentlessly now, repression that seems to go with that, attempts constantly to tighten up and control means of expression, monitor and observe what people do. The government has talked about ID cards and all of that. And, well, vilification of opponents that we see all across Europe today, and very little else. Now, this is a geopolitical program, mostly, and in some respects it is the fear of Russia and the atmosphere of war that seems to me to be the most, well, it's certainly for me the thing that perhaps interests me most. And, well, that seems to be the unifying factor that binds the whole of the European political class together and which makes them feel, well, most involved and engaged, and about which all of the other plans, the ID cards, the security systems, all of those things, that all seems to flow from. I don't believe that we are close to war with Russia. I think Dmitry Medvedev, the vice chairman of the Russian Security Council, got it basically right. He said that the Europeans want to talk up the idea of war because it serves their political interests. But ultimately, they will always back off starting an actual war, not just because they know that they would not survive it, but because they lack the political energy to do it. And I think this is correct. They want to have a war, but not have a war at one and the same time. They want us to feel that we are at war without the war itself actually taking place. A very strange situation and a very surreal one, and one which I doubt can be sustained indefinitely, or even, if I have to be frank, for very long. But anyway, what all that is doing in the meantime is that it's making it more and more difficult to make actual decisions, practical decisions, the kind of decisions that Keir Starmer did not talk about in his speech yesterday, actual decisions about housing, the economy, tax, immigration, whatever issue you are most focused and most concerned about. Because everything that happens now is framed around the subject of war. Indeed, one European politician, Jens Stoltenberg, who I believe now occupies a senior political post in Norway after his long and, in my opinion, disastrous stint as Secretary General of NATO, actually said that, you know, we need to spend more money on weapons and security and all of those things. And of course, that means that we're going to have less money to spend on social programs, infrastructure, housing, education, and all of those things. But security, preparing against the Russian invasion that is never going to come, that is more important than spending money on all of these other things, which in the end might provide some kind of basis for a European economic recovery. But, you know, let's not think about that. Let's not do any of these things, because it's what Mr. Putin is doing and what the Russians might do That is what is really important. So avoid having any real discussions about those things, which, by the way, are difficult to do and which would invite political challenges, which European leaders nowadays no longer relish. So don't discuss or do anything of that kind, but talk incessantly about war and make any attempt to discuss these other things, to focus on them, to try to talk not about fictitious Russian invasions, but about domestic problems. Well, don't talk about those, because if you do, you're obviously playing into the hands of Putin and the Russians. So that's where we reduce to. Now, again, with apologies, I came across recently a quote from James Madison, the brilliant American lawyer and politician who was for a short time president of the United States, who played the major part in drafting the US Constitution. And this is the quote, and it dates from 1795. Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honours, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals engendered by both. No nation can preserve its liberty in the midst of continuous war. Well, that's my feeling. That is my view entirely about the present state of Europe. It can be extended, by the way, to the United States also, and we'll come to them in a moment. But there it is. Our leaders choose this strange state of war, which isn't war, instead of true and genuine peace, and all of the problems that Madison spoke about all those centuries ago are therefore multiplying around us. Now, as to the United States, we've had a whole series of rather interesting events, all of which I suspect dovetail with each other. First of all, this meeting of the 800 generals and admirals and Air Force commanders has now taken place, and they were addressed by the US Secretary of War, as we must now call him, Pete Hegseth, and the President of the United States, Donald Trump. And I think it is fair to say that the speeches that Hegseth and Trump made were largely empty of any substance and of any content. They were the kind of messages that they set out could have been quite easily communicated to all of these generals and admirals and Air Force commanders through emails and other means. It hardly justified bringing them all together in order to give them this kind of pep talk, the kind of pep talk that Hegseth and Trump both gave to them. However, I think, like I know Eve Smith does, that most astute and insightful of commentators, I believe that there is in fact more behind this meeting than appears on the surface. And Pete Hegseth has sent a message to Larry Johnson. You can find it on Sonar 21, in which she says that she suspects that the true purpose of this meeting was not the public part of it, which we have all been shown and which has been televised and which we're reading about everywhere, but the information that has been provided in private to these senior military officials by the President and the Secretary for War and whatever other senior officials from the administration participated in these discussions. Now, firstly, I am getting reports. These are reports being provided to me in confidence that US military people are being called up and that they are being asked to prepare for service and combat. And it is fairly clear, at least to me, that the immediate target is Venezuela. I expect an attack on Venezuela to take place very soon, probably within the next week. It seems to me, again, a bizarre and extraordinary thing to do, to attack Venezuela, a country which, to be very clear, is not currently attacking the United States and which poses no military threat at all to the United States. But this claim that the government of Venezuela is actually a drug cartel has been massively circulated in the United States, as I've discussed in previous programs, it's gained traction. The United States has, as we all know, a widespread social problem in this area. And, well, the narrative that has been constructed around Venezuela fits in very closely, it dovetails in very precisely with any number of Hollywood films and books and thrillers and that kind of thing. So probably there will be a fair amount of support for this military attack when it comes. And I know many people want to believe that the Venezuelan military will be able to give a good and strong account of itself in any attack by the United States. But the balance of forces in Venezuela is massively lopsided in America's favour. Venezuela does have friends and allies, but they are far away. They are geographically very remote from Venezuela. They cannot easily supply weapons and supplies to Venezuela. And in the event of an American attack, Venezuela, unlike, say, Ukraine, will be basically alone. So that makes it, it seems to me, less likely that Venezuela is going to be able to withstand this attack when it comes. Though, obviously, I'm not an expert. I'm not familiar with the internal realities inside Venezuela or the strength and discipline of its armed forces. And I'm not going to make any exact predictions as to what is going to come. But an armed attack on Venezuela, it seems to me, now is an overwhelming probability. And I understand that the Venezuelan government has declared a state of emergency and is trying to rally its forces and is calling up reservists and doing all of those things. And it looks as if they at least are anticipating it. So that is one attack that's coming. And by the way, and for the record, I expect that like all other attacks that the United States and its allies have engaged in recently, the attack is going to take the form, at least initially, of an attempted decapitation strike targeting the Venezuelan leadership. So Venezuela, very much on the firing lines now. And Well, there have also been reports of massive transfers of American supply and transport aircraft to Europe, refueling aircraft and all of that, and of deployments of American fighter jets. And it's been pointed out that something not dissimilar happened on the eve and during the 12-day war between Israel and Iran. And of course, the United States ultimately joined that attack also. And I personally think it is highly likely that we're going to see an attack on Iran also at some point soon, though maybe that attack might come a little less, a little later than the attack on Venezuela will. So all of this calls into question, of course, whether the President of the United States is indeed the peace president that he likes to claim, but we will see these attacks come. The President, over the course of his comments, incidentally, made what I thought was a rather interesting point. He said that he'd expected the Russians to devastate Ukraine, carry out a massive aerial assault across Ukraine in the first days of the war. And he's been disappointed and surprised that the Russians didn't or weren't able to do that. And it seems to me that might give us some sense of what is coming with respect to Iran. A bombing campaign against Iran, which will extend this time right across the entire country. Just saying. So, attacks on Iran on the way. Attack on Venezuela probably imminent. And I come back to the point that James Madison said. Perpetual, continuous war. The President of the United States promised that he would end the forever wars. And we see that, on the contrary, he is taking them to yet another stage. He can't draw back. He's pushed, or perhaps he wants to go, into further wars. And the United States is going to find itself, I predict, in more of them. What will happen in the Venezuela enterprise? I don't know. I am guessing that most Latin American states will not be happy by an American intervention in Venezuela, an armed American intervention to overthrow the government of Venezuela. But it may be, one has to prepare for this possibility, that the regime change operation in Venezuela will, at least for a time, be successful. With Iran, I think it is far more likely that the United States yet again is sowing the dragon's teeth. That is my own assessment of what is currently happening, what the United States is preparing to do. Meanwhile, the peace plan, which I discussed yesterday in my video, the peace plan relating to Gaza, well, it was announced, but there's absolutely no sign that it is being brought into effect. For the moment, the fighting in Gaza continues. This morning, I was reading about how Israel is closing another entry point into Gaza. I'm not going to say that I know the details very closely, but as I said, in a sense, a humanitarian tragedy continues to play out in Gaza. But the central conflict in the Middle East is going to be the one with Iran. Now, Iran, much more difficult adversary than Venezuela. It does have allies. Those allies, Russia and China, are closer to Iran and in a stronger position to provide assistance. But in order for that to happen, Iran will need to show again that it has the ability to defend itself, It just managed that during the 12-day war. The balance shifted to its advantage during that war. But as I said already, I think the attack this time is going to be much more powerful and far more devastating. And Iran has been very slow. It has delayed very long in seeking the assistance of its friends. It has spurned in the past offers of military assistance from Russia, and I suspect from China too, and that has left it weaker and more exposed than it might otherwise have been. Anyway, we will see again how all this plays out, but I expect a very turbulent autumn, and all of this, by the way, at a time when the situation in the global economy is also extremely unstable. Lastly, I am going to finish with these words. Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump obviously had their meeting, and this was the meeting at which the Gaza peace plan was announced. Was that the only topic that they discussed? Perhaps. Was it possible, however, that they discussed also the forthcoming attack on Iran, and that they were briefing and talking about that with each other on the eve of the president's visit to meet with the military officials? Could it be that the announcement of the Gaza peace plan was first and foremost about giving Netanyahu and Trump that opportunity to meet with each other so that they could discuss the strike on Iran? Maybe that was the main topic of discussion, not the Gaza peace plan at all. Let me stress, these are speculations. I don't know that any of this is true. It may be that over the next couple of weeks, there will be no attack on Venezuela and no attack on Iran. And we will see that the plan, the attempted plan to deliver peace to Gaza, is actually brought into effect. But I have to say, I don't, at this moment in time, expect any of that. Anyway, whilst all this is going on, the war in Ukraine continues. And we've had significant amount of information about the battlefield situation and more clarity now about what is happening northeast of Pokrovsk in the area of the Russian breakthrough, in what both the Ukrainians and the Russians refer to as the Dobropilia direction. And suffice to say that the information that has been provided vindicates completely, as far as I could see, the previous reporting provided by Radovka. It is clear now that the Russians are in firm control of the village of Novotoretskoye, which the Ukrainians at one time were claiming to have either recaptured or to have entered or done something of that kind. The Russians also seem to be advancing both to the north and south of the Sharkovo pocket, to the east of the area of this breakthrough. It was in the Sharkovo pocket that the 1st Corps of the Ukrainian National Guard, the forces that make up the bulk of the counterattacking forces in this area, made up mostly of brigades of what must now be called the Azov organization, because they're no longer just a battalion or a brigade. They are now, well, very substantial military units. Anyway, it looks to me as if this was the main area of attack by the Ukrainians, where Syzky organized and arranged for his counterattack. And it's now starting to look as if the Ukrainian forces in this area, in the Charkovo pocket, having already suffered very heavy losses as a result of Russian bombing and Russian drone strikes and Russian artillery strikes and all of those things, are now at significant risk of being cut off and surrounded as the Russian pincers close in on them, both from the north and from the south. So the battle in this area is now clearly and decisively going in the Russian direction. And the same is true on the western side of this Russian breakthrough. The Ukrainians launched a counterattack in that area as well. They broke through and entered and perhaps recaptured the village of Nikaronovka, but the Russians appear to have recaptured it. And again, reports somewhat suggest that in this area also, the Ukrainian forces which carried out that counterattack are at risk of becoming surrounded. And further north, in the area of Kucherov Yar, the Russians appear to have expanded the territory that they control, and it does look as if they're still there in around the village of Zoloty Kolodyas. It's increasingly looking, in other words, as if the Ukrainian counterattacks in this area have failed, and failed completely, and that the Ukrainians, far from achieving breakthroughs and catching the Russians into cauldrons, as General Sirski was claiming, well, only 2 days ago, that on the contrary, the Ukrainians have depleted their forces and wasted away their opportunities to set up stronger defence lines through these counterattacks, which instead have failed. And there's been less information about what's going on within Pokrovsk itself over the last 24 hours. But the last reports, also from Radovka, pointed to significant Russian advances in that inside Pokrovsk itself. And I said in my last video where I discussed the situation in Pokrovsk that it seemed to me that the Russians, if you believe Radovka's maps, now control more than half the town. So anyway, now I'm going to quickly say something else at this point, which is that General Kellogg, as we know, has been meeting Zelensky and the other Ukrainian officials, and he has been claiming that the Ukrainians have been winning the war, that it's the Russians who are losing and the Ukrainians who have been winning. And these claims by Kellogg have now been repeated by the President of the United States, by Donald Trump. And they've been taken up by media outlets like the Financial Times, for example, and have been repeated by others in Europe. I have come to the clear view that what has been happening, is that Kellogg and the Americans have been briefed by Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials about what they say has been happening in the area of the Russian breakthrough northeast of Pokrovsk, that the Ukrainians have been telling the Americans that they not only have the situation in that area under control, but that the Russians are overextended and are being defeated, and that some of their forces have been caught in cauldrons, and that some kind of mopping up operation is underway, and that the Ukrainians have won some kind of important victory. That is what I think has happened. And I think that it is largely Ukrainian claims about the situation northeast of Pokrovsk, which is what has led to a lot of this narrative we have been listening to and hearing over the last couple of days about how it is the Ukrainians, not the Russians, who have been winning the war in Ukraine. Now, that those claims of Ukrainian success northeast of Pokrovsk are turning out to be false and untrue. The Ukrainians are, I think, going to find themselves with a lot of explaining to do to their American friends and to Kellogg specifically. And you can perhaps start to see how, as events northeast of Pokrovsk have gone from favourable to less favourable to unfavourable to outright dangerous for the Ukrainians, the mood in Kiev, which I think improved briefly when the Ukrainians were counterattacking in this area, how the mood is starting to darken again. Because we've had from the Ukrainians, from Zelensky, these increasingly urgent requests now for delivery of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And we've also had a whole succession of extremely alarming claims coming to the Ukrainians about the status and condition of the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. Let me begin, first of all, about the Tomahawk missiles, because General Kellogg talked about this subject again in an interview he gave. And listening to Kellogg, it was absolutely clear to me, in fact, there was no doubt about it, that he is now an advocate. He is the person within the administration who is advocating supply of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And he spoke about this missile as a game changer that is going to transform the situation in the war. How often have we heard this, by the way? Remember the Bayraktar drones, the HIMARS missiles, the M777 howitzers, the story about how the the Western guns outranged the Russian guns and were so much more precise than the Russian guns. Remember all of that? We had the same story about the tanks, the Western tanks and armoured vehicles. I remember reading in the Financial Times accounts about how Western tanks, as compared to Russian tanks, were like Ferraris against Volkswagen Beetles. I actually remember reading an article that said that very thing, modern Ferraris pitted against Volkswagen Beetles. And of course, we had the same story with the ATACMS missiles and with the Storm Shadows. And well, we've had all kinds of similar claims in recent weeks. The Patriots, of course, were going to transform the situation in the sky. Notice how entirely unsuccessful they have been. The F-16s, we don't see much sign of them anymore. The Mirage 2000s, some months ago, there was talk about Sweden providing AWACS-type aircraft to Ukraine. I remember talking all about that. And, well, we don't hear much about those aircraft. I'm not even sure whether they were delivered exactly. Anyway, just saying. And anyway, we've had endless numbers of miracle weapons that have been supplied to Ukraine, or which were going to be supplied to Ukraine, and which were going to transform the war. Just a few weeks ago, as it happened, just about two, 3 weeks ago, I was discussing an air-launched missile that some articles I think it was in the Wall Street Journal were claiming that Ukraine was going to receive 3,000 of them in October, and which were also going to change the entire direction of the battle. Well, we're now in October. Have we heard or seen anything of these weapons? I was sceptical whether they even existed. Others, like Brian Beletic and still others, did some research, and it turned out that prototypes of these weapons had been developed in the spring, but it looked as if deliveries were still far away. Anyway, all of these miracle weapons, and now we have General Kellogg talking about how the Tomahawks are going to be miracle weapons. They're going to be game changers. He did say, and he was careful to say, that the decision to supply these weapons, which he spoke about how incredibly sophisticated and powerful and effective they would be, how much more effective they would be than any other weapon, how he was familiar with this weapon. Anyway, he was careful to say that the Tomahawks, the delivery of the Tomahawks, depended on a decision by the President of the United States. But it was absolutely clear to me from listening to his comments that now that he's come to understand that his previous idea of massive sanctions, tariffs against China, tariffs against India, all of that, that that wasn't going to happen, he now is advocating, and probably he's the leading voice within the administration, trying to persuade the President of the United States to authorize the supply of Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And of course, these will not be supplied directly by the United States to Ukraine. J.D. Vance, the Vice President, has explained the mechanism. They will be supplied to the Europeans, who will pay for them with Russian money, because as I discussed in my program yesterday, the Europeans are now edging towards essentially seizing the Russian frozen assets and dressing it all up as a loan, which they're going to supply to Ukraine. But ultimately, they're going to use that money to buy these weapons from the United States. And they're going to buy the Tomahawks with that Russian money from the United States. And then once they've received in Europe, they will be transferred to Ukraine. That looks to be the current plan. I'm not sure that everybody in Washington is signed up to it. In fact, I doubt that everybody is. But anyway, I think that is what General Kellogg wants to happen and what he appears to be currently advocating. That is my assessment. Again, I accept that this is speculation, but his words were fairly clear to me. Now, I've been receiving an awful lot of information about the situation with Tomahawks, the Tomahawk missiles. And firstly, I want to thank everybody who has written to me about the Tomahawk missiles and who has provided me with an enormous amount of information about these systems. Anyway, here are my own conclusions based on what everybody, or what all of these people have been saying. And to stress again, these are my conclusions, obviously drawing on the information that others have been providing, but these are my own personal conclusions with which people are at liberty to disagree. Let us assume that the Tomahawk missiles are indeed delivered to Ukraine. Let us assume that the Ukrainians find, and the Americans find, some means to launch them from the territory of Ukraine. And we will come to the problems with that in a moment. They are not going to be game changers, even assuming that the Russians simply sit back and treat them like every other missile that the Ukrainians have launched against them. They are not going to be game changers. They cannot be game changers. Now, I have been comparing the Tomahawks with the Russian cruise missiles, the KH-101s and the Calibra missiles. And it seems to me that in spite of what many are saying, the Tomahawks are very similar to these Russian subsonic cruise missiles, except that they're probably less sophisticated. They're less sophisticated because they were developed long before the Russian missiles. The KH-101, for example, has certain stealth characteristics which the Tomahawk doesn't have. This is not about defects of American engineering. It is just that we're dealing with an older system and that the KH-101s and the Calibra missiles are newer systems. Just saying. They carry a very similar warhead and they are roughly the same size. The United States has a limited stockpile of these Tomahawk missiles, and they are probably needed for battle in many other places. The United States has used Tomahawk missiles against various targets at various times. It has recently used them against the Houthis in Yemen with no discernible effect. Just saying. So already we can see that there are issues with these missiles. They can be used. They've been used against targets, including targets recently. When they were used against Syria back in 2017, I accept that there is massive dispute about how many of these missiles the Russian supplied Syrian air defenses were able to shoot down. Some, the Americans claim none. The Syrians claim 71 out of about 130 launched, though the Americans seem to claim that they launched fewer missiles than this. What is indisputable is that the airbase against which the missiles were launched, the Syrian airbase, was back in operation within 7 hours. And, well, you could use Tomahawk missiles to attack Russian oil refineries. But is this really an effective use of these missiles? I know that's what Zelensky has been talking about, but is it really going to be an effective use of these missiles? I hardly think so. And, well, there's likely to be air defences soon installed around these refineries. And of course, you could use these missiles in decapitation strikes against the Kremlin and against industrial facilities, Russian industrial facilities in Western Russia. But again, these are likely to be hardened and fairly well defended. And again, is this really an effective use of these missiles? And bear in mind, these missiles will have to travel a significant distance to reach these targets. They function at low altitudes, but the Russians know that they are coming, would know that they are coming. They would have a shrewd idea of the targets they are intended to strike at. They are large missiles. They're relatively slow. I cannot imagine that the Russian air defense would find it difficult to shoot many, probably the great majority of them down. I know that there is a view that these are difficult missiles to shoot down. But frankly, everything that I have seen about the way in which the war has played out argues against it, at least as far as I can see. And then there continues to be the problem of how to launch them. Now, several people have absolutely correctly pointed out that the Typhon system that I have discussed, which, to be clear, is the only ground-launched system for the Typhoons, for the Tomahawk system, which is in existence, that the Typhon system is barely operational. Apparently, the United States has a grand total of two. Production is supposed to increase over the next year or so. But we're talking about a massive, extremely complex system. It's hardly a system anyway that I think could be easily absorbed or operated by Ukraine. Germany is expected to receive one in 2026, though that might be optimistic. I doubt that we're going to see many or any of these Typhon systems deployed to Ukraine anytime soon. Now, one very interesting and very helpful email discussed the possibility of a simpler system for launching the Tomahawk from within Ukraine. One possibility was a fixed system, but then that would be an easy target for the Russians. They would probably fairly quickly work out where the missiles were being launched from, and sooner or later, sooner rather than later, such a system using presumably the modules from which the Tomahawks are launched on US warships. Those modules would be attacked and would be very quickly destroyed. The Russians have shown now that they're able to track missile launches from inside Ukraine with great accuracy. And non-mobile missiles basically have a short survival rate inside Ukraine. To give one example, the Ukrainians recently deployed a Patriot missile system close to the city of Zaporozhye. This is a, well, not very mobile system. It was used to shoot down a Russian fighter jet, by some accounts a Sukhoi 35 or a Sukhoi 34, and it was destroyed itself as a result almost immediately. So the Russians are able to track missile launches with very great accuracy. Any Tomahawk system deployed in Ukraine in order to survive for any length of time would have to be mobile. And, well, the alternative suggested in this email was a much simpler, large, big truck mounted system. Simpler, obviously, than the Typhon, and used with much simpler operating systems than the Typhon system does. And the comparison made was with the Harpoon onshore system, also a truck mounted system, that back in 2022 was being developed by the United States. Now, the trouble is that there is no word of such a truck-mounted Tomahawk system being in existence. Now, it's possible that the United States is already developing such a system and has managed to keep it secret, though for various reasons, I think that is unlikely. We're talking about, therefore, the development of a completely new and entirely untested system. The Tomahawk is a significantly bigger and heavier missile than the Harpoon system. So even if you reduce the number of missiles carried, and bear in mind that Tomahawks in as conventional missiles are expected to be launched in clusters, in swarms, and not just one missile at a time. Anyway, you'd have to reduce the number of tomahawks to perhaps two per truck, which already, as I said, undermines the effectiveness of a system of this kind. The Typhon system, by the way, carries four. And, well, if I have to say it straightforwardly, the United States has consistently found it difficult to develop simpler systems of this kind. The American military industrial complex is very heavily geared, as far as I can see, to developing more complex, more sophisticated systems. When it tries to produce simpler ones, like the small diameter bomb launched on the HIMARS, the HIMARS launch systems, or this new air-to-ground missile that we were reading about just a few weeks ago, those kind of programs seem to run into difficulties and never quite fulfill their promise. If we're talking about the truck-mounted Harpoon system, I'm going to say straight away that we heard an awful lot about it in 2022. There was talk that it was being developed alongside or together with the Danes. Photos have appeared of this system operated by the Danes, and there was word that it had been supplied to the Ukrainians, and it was suggested at various times that it had been used in 2022 to strike the Moskva cruiser, only that was then denied, and that it was used in the attacks against Snake Island by the Ukrainians. Only that has also been denied, by the way. And having followed the battle for Snake Island closely, I don't believe that missiles of that kind were used in that battle. And since then, so far as the conflict in Ukraine itself has been concerned, there hasn't been any more word about the mobile Harpoon system. Maybe it was supplied, but then a decision made that was made that it wasn't serving any useful purpose and was withdrawn, or maybe it was never supplied at all, or maybe it was supplied and proved disappointing. I don't know. Anyway, it's possible that something like this could be tried with the Tomahawk, but I think we're talking again about a bigger and more complex industrial challenge than perhaps is fully understood. Now, let me stress, this is my own view, but it's based to some extent on tracking what the history of American military procurement over the period of this war has been. Now, on that topic, and just to continue on this topic, the United States, we're getting reports that the United States, the Pentagon, is now very concerned about the depletion of many of its missile inventories. And I've noticed that pretty much all of the missiles in question, apart from the JASSMs, are missiles that have been supplied in profligate numbers to Ukraine, just saying, which is the reason why there's been the depletion of these missile arsenals. Anyway, supposedly, the Pentagon is now demanding that the US industry quadruple production of these missiles. And industry sources are already pushing back and are saying that this cannot be done. It simply cannot be done. And that it would require tens of billions of further investment in expanded production facilities in the United States. And I have no doubt that that is true. And I'm going to say something else, which is that people who demand an immediate quadrupling of production of missiles I think, again, don't understand the complexities and challenges of an industrial process. In order to quadruple production, you need raw materials, you need skilled labour, you need secure supply chains, you need a proper organisation of production. That takes time to set up. If you try to do this too fast, if you throw money at the problem, then all you're going to do is, yes, you're going to get a small increase in production, but at much higher cost. You might end up increasing missile production, not fourfold as you wish, but perhaps by 20 to 50%, but at sixfold the cost. Unit costs, if this kind of thing isn't handled intelligently and effectively, can explode. And everything about the American procurement system suggests to me that this is exactly what will happen with this program. We have seen the debacle of American artillery shell production. The United States is far below targets on artillery shells. The Turkish factory that was bought, you know, almost complete from Turkey, apparently it's still not working. The existing factory is also having problems increasing production of shells. Shell production in the United States has indeed increased significantly from the absolute low that it had fallen to before the start of the special military operation. But it is nowhere close to meeting the necessary targets. The reasons that the Russians have been able to increase production of military equipment so much more effectively than the Americans have been able to do, or the Westerners have been able to do, is because Russian industry is designed that way. It is designed to function at much lower levels of capacity, so that when there is a military crisis, it can surge. And the Russians always keep back reserves of strategic minerals, materials, in order to ensure that that kind of supply surge can be maintained over the distance. And then, of course, they have the project managers and the engineers and the logistics people to make sure that that can be sustained even once those reserves have been run through. The American system, based on time deliveries and things of that kind, simply isn't designed in that way. And it would require a managerial and industrial revolution within the United States to achieve it. And that, of course, doesn't even address problems like rarity of rare earths, of which China has a virtual monopoly, and of which it is currently restricting supply. So, just to say, I don't believe that there is a magical weapon that can be supplied to Ukraine. I certainly don't believe that the Tomahawk system is that magic system. If KH-101s and Calibras launched against Ukraine have managed to do significant damage, but have not been able by themselves to win the war, I cannot see how, with all of the deployment problems and the operational problems, use of what is bound to be a smaller quantity of older designed Tomahawk missiles against the far bigger Russian defense and industry complex, backed by its resilient air defense system, I cannot see how that can achieve the outcome that people expect. And of course, the Russians are busy deploying Oreshnik missiles now to Western Russia. I've had one report that there are now 140 of these missiles already produced and entering service. 140. And, well, these are non-interceptable. They are potentially devastating. And, well, they're being deployed in increasing numbers. And in any sane world, they would act as an effective deterrence against Tomahawk use. Just saying. Anyway, that's my view. Now, let's talk about other situations on the battlefront, and let's return to the topic of the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, because over the last week, the Ukrainians have been busy telling everybody that there is a crisis brewing in the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, that electrical supply to the plant is being interrupted. Zelensky has made further statements about this over the last 24 hours. He's talked about the Russians shelling the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. He never explains why the Russians would want to shell the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, which they themselves control. Just saying. And he is talking about a potential security crisis at the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. Now, I have to say that yet again, I am not hearing about anything similar from the Russians. The Russians have never in the past hesitated to speak about dangers or a crisis at the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant when one did appear to be threatened. And of course, they have repeatedly said that it is the Ukrainians who are shelling the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, and that makes logical sense, if I may say, since it's the Russians who control this power plant. And I remember that the New York Times, some years ago, by the way, about 2 years ago, let slip that it was indeed the Ukrainians who were shelling the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. The Ukrainians have made multiple efforts to recapture the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. I remember that back in 2022, they tried to conduct commando raids across the Dnieper to recapture the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. They seemed so preposterous to me that I discounted them. I didn't believe them. I thought they were, the stories of them must be Russian propaganda, except subsequently reports in the Western media confirmed that the Russian accounts were true. So the Russians firmly control the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. They are advancing in Zaporozhye region. Perhaps the Ukrainians are still shelling the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. I haven't heard the Russians complain about that very much recently. No doubt there are problems with power lines and things of that kind, though the Russians claim that they are building a power line to the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, which might be the trigger of Ukrainian concern, because increasingly it looks as if this important power plant, the biggest in Europe, is becoming increasingly integrated into the Russian energy system. And the Ukrainians seem very alarmed and concerned about that. But for the moment, at least, at this particular point, the situation does seem to be under relative control, at least as far as I can see. So why are the Ukrainians playing this story up? Well, I am going to suggest that the reason is not what is going on in the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. It is what is happening on the Ukrainian front lines in Zaporozhye region. The Ukrainians are desperately short of men in this region. The Russians appear to be steadily capturing the town of Stepnogorsk, south of Zaporozhye city. And as I said already, there is a body of water between these places and the city of Zaporozhye itself. And I don't expect, therefore, a Russian advance on Zaporozhye city from the south. But the Russians are indeed now very close to Zaporozhye city. But the real crisis for the Ukrainians is coming from the Russian advance from the east. And over the last 24 hours, it looks as if the Russians have begun the storming operation on the Poltavka, Uspenovka villages, which the Ukrainians have tried to fortify. One of the cluster of villages in this particular area, which the Ukrainians are trying to defend and which they've tried to develop into a defence line. Once the Russians have broken that defence line, they'll be able to advance westwards, cutting off the supply lines to the important town of Gulyapolye to the south, making its defence probably untenable. And then, of course, the Russians no doubt intend or plan to advance further west towards the town of Orekhov. And it's been suggested that they might be attacking Orekhov from the westward direction as well. In other words, Orekhov could be taken into a kind of pincer. And as I've discussed already, if Orekhov falls, that only leaves the city of Zaporozhye itself as the last remaining important habitation under Ukrainian control in Zaporozhye region. And the Ukrainians must also be worried that the Russians are now also advancing in Dnipro region as well, that the Russians seem to be advancing remorselessly towards the river, and there doesn't seem to be anything that the Ukrainians can do to hold them back. And I suspect that this is what lies behind the latest alarm bells that the Ukrainians are ringing about the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant. They're saying, you have to do something. You have to stop, help us stop the Russian advance in this area. You've got to force the Russians to agree a ceasefire or force or agree to some kind of Western military deployment in this area, because the situation is becoming critical. The Zaporozhye nuclear power plant is about to suffer a major accident. If that happens, you're going to be facing another Chernobyl. I think this is what this narrative is all about. It is about Russian advances, more about the situation in the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant itself. Now, I hope I am not being complacent and that the situation in the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant is, as I have said, well, if it is indeed critical, then the people who have been shelling it, who I believe are the Ukrainians, are the ones who must be ultimately responsible. But having said that, I am reasonably sure that my assessment here is the correct one. Elsewhere on the battlefronts, well, the situation continues to deteriorate for the Ukrainians as well. And Radovka gave a very detailed account of the fighting around Liman and spoke about how Ukrainian defences northwest of Liman have basically collapsed with the fall of the village, the important village of Shandrikolova, and that it's also collapsed in light of the successful Russian capture of a village, which from memory I believe is called Zvarizhne, I might be wrong, to the east of Liman. And it could be that the major battle of Liman is about to begin again. And I've discussed in recent programs the increasing crisis the Ukrainians have been facing in Kupiansk and how their forces there appear to be surrounded. And, well, the Russian media today, the official Russian media, is talking about further closing of the ring around the important fortified town of Siversk. And the Battle of Siversk, if I have to say this, to me, looks ever more like the Battle of Ugledar, which took place a year ago. I expect that Ukrainian resistance in Siversk is going to collapse in much the same way as the battle as it collapsed in Ugledar. Anyway, I am not going to discuss those things in detail. Suffice to say that the Russian advance continues, and Tomahawk missiles, assuming that they're ever supplied, massive escalatory step as they will be, will not stop it. The Russians, by the way, said as much. There's been comments from the Russians about this. The Tomahawk missiles are not going to change the outcome on the battlefields. Lavrov, by the way, has given the administration an off-ramp on this. He says that he doesn't believe that Trump himself will do this reckless thing. We shall see. Anyway, but I suspect that if I'm right about what I was saying earlier in this program, the major story is going to be American attacks on Venezuela within the next couple of days, and perhaps the renewed attack on Iran that will come shortly after. Anyway, we shall see. I hope I'm wrong, but that is what I think. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by checking out our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.